Hi, I'm Vanessa Bayer, and this is my brother, Jonah.
We're two siblings who love to talk about our childhood and nostalgia and how it shaped us into the people we are today.
Who are extremely good listeners, if I do say so myself.
Welcome to How Did We Get Weird?
Jonah, I thought we could talk today about your history as kind of a teenage scam artist. Do you want to kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah. So I was thinking about topics, and I think that the statute of limitations on this has passed by a long time.
Yeah. I don't think you're in any trouble of getting arrested or anything.
I don't think so. This was a very long time ago. But yeah, I had a scam going to get free CDs when I was a teenager.
I think we can say you had it going with your friend. I think we can name your friend.
My friend Dan. And so my friend Dan, and he got introduced to it by someone else. You know, this was pre-message boards, you know, word of mouth. And we were told, if you go to Borders and you return a book, you don't need a receipt, and they will give you the price on the jacket. And
wow.
Borders sells CDs. They had like a huge music section. So they were like, you can get books, return them and buy CDs. So we were like, okay, let's try this. So we would go to this Walden Books down the street, and they'd have like five hardcover books on sale for $20, like on this table. And we would buy five books for $20. We would drive like a few blocks down to Borders, return the books, and get like $100 in store credit and buy like, I'm sure our guests today will know, like we used to get these import CDs that were so expensive. I mean, it was like, you know, like a Bell and Sebastian import had like three songs. It had like, it was like $30. So, and they had all kinds of stuff. They had Gigi Allen imports. They had all kinds of like imported CDs. They had a really well curated music section. This was obviously like pre-streaming. So we would all the time go to Walden Books, buy just whatever random book, go to Borders. And so I was extra paranoid. I actually had a fake ID that some guy had given me, and they would take down your name when you did the return. And I was so paranoid that I was like, someone at Borders Corporate is going to check the names, be like, this Jonah Bayer guy is returning a lot of books. And so I started using this fake ID to return books. And that's sort of where things started to fall apart.
Okay. Now, just quickly, did Dan also use a fake ID, or were you kind of the... Okay.
I happened to have one, and it was a really bad one.
Okay.
But I was so paranoid. But the fake ID wasn't essential. It was just like an extra step of security for me.
Right.
It turned out to be my downfall.
Yeah, I can see this. Yeah.
So what happened was, we're doing it. We're racking up these CDs. I got tons of CDs. And we go one day, and my friend Matt's sister is a manager at this Borders. I didn't realize. So I go, and I remember the book I'm returning, and I looked it up. And it's called The Corporate Closet, The Professional Lives of Gay Men in America. It's from 1993. And it's a book about basically gay men, how they handle their sexuality in corporate culture, which, by the way, 1993, probably a very important book.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, not to trivialize the book, but probably not something like a teenager watching skateboarding videos is going to be just like reading. You know, it was right. Literally just like whatever was on this Walden Books sale table. So I bring the book up. I got my fake ID. I got some kind of weird European import CD that I'm ready to get into. And during the process, my friend Matt's sister, who's a manager, goes, "Oh, hey, Jonah." And the guy doing the return looks at the ID. The ID was Paul. And this guy looked nothing like me. And they're like, "Why is this ID say your name is Paul?" And
okay, I remember how the story ends, and it's really
as
funny.
Any teenager would do in a tough situation. I said, "Hold on. I forgot something in my car, and I just left." And I remember my friend Matt, whose sister worked there, being like, "Yeah, my sister said you came into the store today, tried to return some weird book with a fake ID, and then when she asked you about it, you just left." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I don't know, you know, like, you know." And that was basically the end of it. I think, like, eventually Borders started needing receipts for stuff, like every other store.
Right.
And then Borders went out of business and Walden Books went out of business. You know, the legality of it to me was always questionable because in a way, you know, we could have gotten these books as a gift and we're just returning them. We're like, maybe we got this as a gift and they were bought at Borders. We don't know.
Right.
And so we felt like there was always that gray area.
And to be fair, you were actually really supporting Walden Books. Like, you were buying a lot
That's true.
Books and stuff from them. So you were really big supporters of them. Look, Borders, if that's their policy, they're kind of...
Yeah.
They wouldn't give you back money, right? Like, they would only give you store credit.
No, only store credit.
Okay, so, yeah.
But I definitely think, like, some of the workers would see, like, us returning all of these books on, like, woodworking or these random subjects and then just buying a bunch of CDs. Like, something sure seemed off, but I think there was nothing they could do until they figured it out, and then that was it. But I think I was too paranoid about it. And I think using, you know, an alias really is what showed me up.
Yeah. And just to say, thinking about the day that you got caught, there's other reasons you could have felt flustered and left. You know, you might have actually bought that book from Borders and been like really interested in corporate lifestyle for someone who is in the closet and then using an ID because you didn't want to, you know what I mean? And
sure,
so there's
sure,
a lot of
sure.
reasons, but she probably knew that it was just because you were pulling a scam. Okay.
And yeah, I've never talked about that publicly. So maybe other people were doing it. Maybe no one else was doing it. Maybe it was like, who knows? But it's nostalgic because it's of a time that will never happen again.
Yeah. And if anyone, you know, comes after us, we'll say this is a story.
Yeah, it's just a story. Never really happened. And I do not condone stealing or doing anything illegal. So today on the podcast, we have an amazing guest. When we started doing this podcast, this was one of the first people we dreamed of getting. He's a drummer, a comedy writer. As a musician, you know him was his work in Superchunk, The Mountain Goats, Bob Mould. He's also known for appearing in The Best Show with Tom Sharpling, where he plays amazing characters like Philly Boy Roy, a Bayer favorite. Let's give it up for John Worster.
Hello!
Hey,
hi,
John. How's
John.
It going?
Hi. Good to be here.
We're so excited to have you. We're such huge fans and couldn't be more thrilled.
Well, thank you. Right back at both of you.
Thank you. So, John, did that border story bring up any memories for you?
Well, first let me say, I'm allergic to being in trouble. So for me to do anything willfully, like criminal, I can't do it. Like,
yeah.
I still have anxiety and guilt about, I was rehearsing with, this was over 25 years ago. I was rehearsing with a band in Athens, Georgia called Magna Pop. Their drummer had to leave or something. So I was about to do a tour with them, and I was staying at one of their houses, and I backed out of their driveway after the final day of rehearsal to go home to Chapel Hill. And I didn't see this parked car behind me, who was their neighbor's car, and I hit it and I left. I never left a note or anything. And I still, anything that bad happens to me, I think it's retribution for,
gotcha,
for that. So, I only ever stole something once in my life, and it was a pack of, chewing tobacco from this general store across the cornfield from where I grew up. And of course I got instantly sick on it. So maybe that was my first lesson in the karmic realities of breaking the law. So, but I love your story. I love that you had the guts to engineer a scam like that. It's very impressive.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm like you, John. I'm the same way. I get so freaked out when I do anything like that, and stuff like that I will remember, even to the point where, like, sometimes if I get something for free, like, you know, if I'm charged the wrong amount or something, I have to say something to them. And on the off chance I don't, because it's like, you know, I've had like food delivery stuff where this one restaurant always gives me like double what I order. And so I'll like get on the phone with like one of the food delivery things, and I'll be doing like the automatic like typing, like trying to get them to see. I'm like, I just want to make sure it's not someone else's food that I got, you know what I mean? And it's like after like a half hour, I'm like, I think I just have to like let this go. But like, I will put myself really through the ringer trying to like straighten that stuff out, because it really stresses me out. And Jonah, I bet you get stressed out about that stuff too.
I do. Yeah. I really do. I can't think of a specific example, but I do get like that now. But I think when I was a teenager, you know, like your brain is not fully developed. I think that I had such a lack of, not to give myself a pass, I would never do something like that now, but I think it was like, I didn't really think things through, as evidenced by like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just going to go in my car and drive home. Like, that will be my solution to this. I don't know how to answer this. I'm just going to leave.
Those are my favorite stories. Like, and they're kind of the basis of a lot of the best show calls are just people that have an idea like that. And it gets bigger and bigger, and the lie gets bigger and bigger, and until it consumes them. There's this great ESPN 30 for 30 on this guy that he claimed to be a multimillionaire, and he ended up buying the what are they called, the Islanders hockey team. So this is back, I think, in the 80s, and complete scam. And he tells the story of like being so far into the scam where he's basically he's getting out of a day of being found out. Like the day he's going to be found out, he has to submit this check for like whatever $3 million to the owners of the owners of the Islanders, and he just decides, well, I'll just make it $3,000 and just say that it's a mistake. And so every day, every morning, I would get up and I would hear the grandfather clock in my house just ticking, and I just knowing this is going to be the day I'm going to get found out. I need to think of something just to get through this day. And I just stories like that, it's so alien to how I live that they're just so fascinating. Like what makes someone do that and then then double down and continue? I guess you just can't get out of it.
Yeah.
Until you're arrested.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Oh my God. I mean, I was curious, John, like how do you, cause we were just listening to an episode this morning, Brian and Silver Lake on, The Best Show. I mean, how do you come up with all these characters? Cause there is kind of a commonality, but they're all so kind of different at the same time.
Just to say to people who are unfamiliar, John calls into The Best Show with Tom Sharpling a lot. They and he plays different characters and he talks to Tom in different accents and stuff. And it's truly, it's really one of the funniest things in the world. But anyway, so yes, John, how do you come up with these characters?
Well, the stories come first, like the actual idea for, and they're almost, I would say 80% of them are based in some way on a real life experience. And that's what I love about touring in bands is that every day's something new and stupid. Like you meet someone that's you know, as nuts as you are or worse, or I'll misread a sign or something, and that will just plant an idea of, oh, what if that did exist? What if there was something like that? But I think the basis for a lot of the calls that Tom and I do is that unwarranted confidence that people have. Unearned confidence. To me, that's endlessly fascinating. And so, but we're kind of living in a world where that's actually getting you somewhere.
Right.
You know, you really do. These people are faking it until I guess they go to jail. But so that's a lot of it. A lot of it's from real life experiences. And we'll just kind of come up with an idea, a way to make it a call. And then, you know, we'll just kind of turn it into a story. And this call usually ends up with me getting arrested or killed.
Can you give an example of like a real life story and how it translated into a character? Just curious, just because we're so fascinated by this.
Well, Philly Boy Roy, who's sort of like, I guess the one I'm known for most, he's based on a lot of real people that I've known over my life from Philly. Some are relatives, so I can't really get that deep. But I'll just say there's one particular relative who embodies what I said earlier. And so often I'll sort of channel that person's thing into the call. But I'm trying to think of like a real life experience that ended up like that. One time I was coming out of the supermarket here in Chapel Hill, and I hear this woman, this older woman, scream. And I have my cart. She has her cart. And I guess she slipped or something. So she's probably in her late 70s, and she's laying there in the parking lot. And it's something I don't see ever. So like there was a moment of like, I look at her and I look into her eyes and I'm just like kind of frozen for like a millisecond. Like, oh my God, you don't see that every day. And she looks at me and is angry and goes, "Help me up." and so that became a call where I helped someone and they were so mad at me that I decided to not help them. at the last second. So that became a whole thing. We did a call. I don't want to get in too much trouble, but the other, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we did a call where I played a guy and he reveals at the end that he has these neighbors who drives a motorcycle and it's very loud and he goes up and down the street. And eventually I called the cops on him several times and eventually he goes speeding up my road and it's very late. So no one else is around and he gets in an accident. And I came up to him and he wanted my help and I leaned over and I said, "You shouldn't have been driving that fucking fast. You know, what do you think you're doing?" And I left him there. And so that was inspired by a real neighbor who I would never do that to.
So
that's an example of like something that just kind of makes its way into a call that's torn from the pages of real life. And I just hope that teenager is not listening right now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because Vanessa, growing up, did a lot of, I don't want to give Vanessa in trouble, but did a lot of impressions of family members. I feel like teachers were some of your first impressions.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's who you're around all the time and you're right. Observing them so much. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I know we've talked about the Philly connection because we have a lot of Philadelphia, you know, family in Philly and the time that we had our grandmother call her friend and we recorded her friend talking about potatoes.
And we sent it to you, John, because we just
I remember
believe.
That.
Yeah.
It's a yeah. real thing.
Yeah, and when you're talking about the unearned confidence, I was thinking about me and John sometimes send each other articles from this website, Blabbermouth, which is like a metal, like rock site, and it's some of the headlines on the site sound like skits. I mean, it sounds like it's not even based in reality.
Right.
Like, they're, you know, like it is crazy how much of this stuff actually exists kind of in our culture at this point, like that attitude.
It's nuts. It's nuts. It's just... ultimately, it shows other people that they can do it too, or they should do it too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I don't think anyone should do it.
Yeah. Now, John, you have some really interesting, I wanted to ask you, you have some really interesting like hashtag, things that you do on social media, on Instagram. You have hashtag rock and roll weirdness and hashtag my new worst friend. How did those, do you want to talk about those for a second and how those came up? Because I feel like in some way they're kind of an extension of what you're talking about of people, especially the my worst friend is like people being so confident, so confidently doing something so abhorrent or disgusting.
Yeah, it's crazy. I honestly, at this point, don't know when it started, when my new worst friend started. It feels like it's just been, it's part of my existence from day one at this point, even though it's probably only been 5 years. One thing that really surprises me is basically I get sent these signs every day that people see. And they're all like vaguely sexual in a way where you know the person that made the sign has no idea that it's sexual. And half the time they're religious too. Like I get a lot of these church marquees, you know, and they all have the word come in them. You know, like let the Lord come in you. That sort of thing. And so I guess it's there's a level of obliviousness too that I really appreciate.
Yeah.
And lack of awareness. So I think that all plays into it. But ever since I started that hashtag, it's like it's become clear that sort of thing just has permeated all of society at this point. It's like there's those of us that know that this is sexually offensive, what you've just paid someone to make into a sign. And then there's this other portion of society that I guess their minds aren't in the gutter like ours.
So, right. Totally.
Seriously. And the rock and roll weirdness is just something I've always been interested in. Like I love, you know, there are these bands and artists where they're just kind of synonymous with one, like a specific instrument or a specific thing. And it's rare to see them outside of that bubble. Like the rock and roll weirdness number one was Malcolm Young, who was the rhythm guitarist in AC/DC. And he was synonymous with this specific model of guitar, Gretsch guitar. And it was a picture of him playing live with a Fender Telecaster, which is very unlike him. I guess all the spares were out of tune at that show or something, so that he got that. But so I love stuff like that. And I was kind of surprised it took off, because it just feels like 0.02% of the population would find it interesting. You know what I mean? So,
well, and a lot of times it's like certain musicians with other musicians that you would just never think they would hang out with. Those are some of my favorites.
Yeah. And maybe you guys have this. I came from a time where everything was pretty factionalized. Like, I didn't. You know, I had no affinity for heavy metal. So when like punk and metal kind of mixed, that's not my world. Like, I didn't like it. I still don't approve of it. But so like stuff like that, where, you know, you would never see whatever Dee Snider with the singer from Millions of Dead Cops or something like that. But
right.
But I think now that there's way less baggage now. Everything. All the lines are blurred, and I think in a good way, where they're like, I don't know if kids today have that chip on their shoulder about stuff. Like I think kids today, they don't have the baggage of us, where, oh, Flock of Seagulls suck.
Yeah, right.
You know what
right.
I mean? You know, right. Like, Flock of Seagulls kind of don't suck anymore. And I think a kid today will just hear it as music. Whereas, whatever, I didn't like heavy metal because the kids in my high school I thought were assholes.
Yeah.
So it's tainted for me. It still is, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, it is literally my favorite thing, and maybe my favorite thing in comedy, when you do something like Dan Rather being the original bassist in Minor Threat or something. I mean, it is just so funny. Just, I can't.
We love the idea. One of the funniest things for me is someone knowing something they shouldn't know about. Like, we've done that forever, where, oh yeah, Trump has a band. Yeah, Barack Obama has a hardcore band, but he wanted to be on Discord, but Ian doesn't, even though they are in D.C., he doesn't feel that they're a real D.C. band, so he's not going to put it out. So I just love, or Springsteen being so upset about, like, he's so frugal that he has a job when he gets off tour. Like, he works at Pet Boys. Like, to me, that's the funniest. Just, it's so stupid that it's... It's great.
Yeah.
Says
yeah. Yeah. That, and the other thing that you do that I love so much, and I think Tune the Weeds, is when you talk about a TV show that only aired once and make it sound so insane.
The final moments of Archie Bunker, where he's sent to the electric chair. They only aired it once.
Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break, but we'll be right back with John Worster.
And we're back. John, by the way, I just got a promo of the new Superchunk record. There's a new record coming out. We should mention that.
Yes. Coming out February 25th, Wild Loneliness, recorded under unusual circumstances. We did, it was all recorded in homes. No studio involved, as far as I know.
In separate homes.
I would go over to Mac, our main guy's basement. Maybe once a week or so, I'd learn a song. He would do demos, and I would learn a song for that week on the drums, and I would go over and I would record the drums. He has a nice Pro Tools set up in his basement, and I would go and do the drums, and then Jim would come over and do his guitar, and then I think he would send it to Laura, and Laura would do that at her bass at her home. So it was all, we were never in the same room, but it sounds good. We got the guy that mixed our 95 album, Here's Where the Strings Come In, to mix it, and he did a fabulous job of making it sound like a real band in a real studio.
Great.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, I interviewed Mac recently about his solo album, and I think he did a lot of it at his house too.
Yep.
And obviously John plays with so many amazing artists. I really wanted to just really quickly, before getting the topic, talk about Bob Mould, because I'm such a huge, huge fan. And I know you're such a huge music fan.
Yeah.
And what's it sort of like? Like, I guess my question for you is, like, if I was on tour with Bob, I feel like I would be asking him so many questions about who's going to do. Are you like that? Or do you kind of play it cool because you're more like peers?
Oh, no, I ask him everything. It's like being a Beatles fan and being, you know, playing with any of the Beatles. So
yeah,
one of my favorite moments was we played on Letterman, and the next day we had a show somewhere. Maybe we were going to Toronto or something. So we were driving maybe 4 hours after doing Letterman, and the entire ride, I was going through the Husker Du wiki and just asking him to name as many songs off each album as he could. And it was great because there were a bunch he didn't know, you know, on the early records. And he's not a guy that really looks back that much. So I'm sure I was annoying at first, but I think eventually he got to appreciate it. And I think at one point he said something like, you know, when we're all gone, you're going to be the only guy with these stories left. But yeah, to get to play those songs, you know, that was such a big part of my formative years. And I still listen to Husker Du and Sugar and his solo records just for pleasure. So to get to play those songs is incredible.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And it all started with your first drum set, which is our topic today, first instruments.
Yes.
And John, could you talk a little bit? You sent some great photos of it, of kind of your first kit and how it all started.
Basically, I always had an interest in the drums. The drums for a child, it's like a sports car almost, like a toy car. Like it's because there's all kinds of stuff going on. It's very, you know, it's mesmerizing to a kid. And so I was always just mesmerized by the drummers. And I must have been like, you know, playing with pencils or something, you know, and my parents got me this toy drum kit out of the Sears catalog. And but it's seriously a toy kit. Like the heads were actually paper and stuff, but when you're a child you don't hit that hard, so you're not going to break them. So I'm sure I futzed around on that when I probably got it when I was 7 or 8. And by chance I found a pristine version of the same drum kit at my friend Darren Hill's shop called Pop. In he has the greatest vintage shop on earth in Providence, and he had just a pristine copy of this kit from back then. So I bought it, and it lives there as a, I guess as an art piece, in the store still. But the great thing about this kit is, it's got a photo on the bass drum of three guys from probably the early 70s playing in a band, and They're probably in their early 20s, so they're grown adults, but the drummer is playing the child's drum kit in the photo. So it's just like, it's very bizarre, and I'm sure I was just, I would think about that photo as much as I thought about the actual drums back then. Like, this poor guy has to sit at this, he's 20, but he's sitting at this drum kit for a 7-year-old. Anyway, I'm sure that kid didn't last long. And then on my 12th birthday, I came home from playing, this is a term that will, I'm sure does not exist anymore. I played midget football, which was a football league for preteens. So I was 12, and I got home from a big game on my birthday, October 31st, 1978, I guess. So I get home from this big game where I was the captain, and I got to call the coin flip, because it was my birthday, and there's a drum kit there, like a better drum kit, which was still kind of bad, but it was like a real drum kit. And so I must have played that for at least 2 years, and then got a better drum kit when I was 14, and that's the drum kit I had for my punk rock years. But I still can't believe that my family put up with me playing the it's That's like the big key, besides being kind of born. I think drummers are born as drummers. I think it's just something that's in you, but you need parents who can support that and not just shut it down. Because there's probably so many great drummers out there who were just shut down by their parents who just couldn't take the noise.
Yeah. You know? Oh, for sure.
So, ultimate love and respect for my parents for that.
Absolutely.
But the worst thing would have been had I given up, like what if I just stopped playing at 20 after subjecting everyone in the neighborhood to that
right.
drumming for like 7 years? Oh,
right.
Can you
yeah.
imagine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, our dad was a drummer, right? He played the
yeah,
drums,
our dad
but then
drums.
He kind of did what you're talking about. I think he probably stopped around when he went to college. So his family,
yeah.
I don't even remember him talking about that aspect of it, of the loudness of it. Although I sure do remember Jonah's bands in our basement playing so
yeah.
loud.
Yeah.
What were these bands called?
Okay. First one was Plug. We were really, that was more of like a, I've talked about this podcast. We got kicked out of doing a talent show at our high school because our singer started a mosh pit and spit on someone in the audience.
Yes.
We did a lot of Misfits covers that band. Then I was in a band called DAF Militia, which stood for Drunk as Fuck. But yes. I think that me and the other guy in the band were straight edge at the time.
I was going to say, was that around your straight edge days?
And then I was in a band. Then I moved into more hardcore bands. I was in a band called Provoke. I was in a band called Due Respect, D-U-E Respect. Some of the band names are pretty good.
All right, so you had DAF in your name. I always struggled with this with my parents, where I can't tell them the full name of this thing. Like I can't say, yeah, we're going to open for a band called Useless Pieces of Shit. And so what did you tell them what it stood for?
I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember.
I bet you I didn't.
I mean, I think I was always in these like different punk bands with all these other kids from other schools. So I don't know how much my parents were even in the loop of like what I was doing at that point once I had a car. You know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah.
My grandmother thought or assumed that I was in an orchestra. Like she would like ask how the orchestra was, how it was doing. And then, oh, it was great. It's great.
What were some of your early band names?
First band was Hair Club for Men. And this was 81. We were half original, half covers, but we would cover like songs the Ramones covered. So like Do You Wanna Dance, Let's Dance, stuff like that. Plasmatics song that they covered by Bobby Darin. And our originals were kind of like the Police, sort of. And it's funny, I just reconnected with the singer for the band after not seeing him for probably 40 years. We played in Mountain Goats played in New Haven a couple weeks ago, and he came. So that was great. And then after that was the Automatics. And then Psychotic Norman was the first kind of real band I played in, where I would drive into the city and rehearse and we would play shows with we opened for the Minutemen a couple of months before D. Boone died. Suicidal Tendencies. So this is like 83 to 85. Those were the three bands before I moved to North Carolina in early 86 and joined this band called The Right Profile, which was kind of like a roots rock band that ended up getting signed by Clive Davis just a few months after I joined. So that's it's a whole other thing.
Wow. So much to your career, John. It's hard to keep track. Vanessa, you started on a piano, not to leave you out of this music combo.
Yeah. Well, we got a piano when we were younger. We both played piano. That was probably both of our first instrument, Jonah. I think I played for a little bit longer than you, but you kind of came back. You then started playing other instruments, whereas I wish I still played piano, but I played for like a lot of years. I had some really like interesting piano teachers. Like because you end up going to their houses. One of my teachers collected owls. Like I remember I would wait. She was like kind of mean and I would just wait in her, like in the lobby with our mom, and they were just like, look at these owls. And then she would like kind of get mad at me for not like practicing enough. And then I went to like my friend Carrie Schloss's teacher, who was like way more quirky and just like didn't care if I was like way nicer. But it is like, I think, and then there was another, like I do remember the overarching theme was that they would be so mad if you weren't practicing a lot. Like it was just like going in there and they could tell if you hadn't practiced, and it was like, well, you're completely fucked if you didn't practice. Like they're gonna know. And I was also generally like a good kid, so like I wasn't used to being like in trouble, but I would just like go to because I was like, I have other stuff to do. I can't like be practicing piano all the time.
No. If you're not into it too, it's torturous. Like, you know, I was lucky that I liked the drums, but still when you start, when you're a kid, you know, you're on a little drum pad. So like, there's none of the fireworks, you know, of like a drum kit. So it's very frustrating. And it's no wonder most people don't stick with anything. You know, it's not fun at first. It's gotta be fun.
Exactly. I remember I got my first guitar when I was probably about 13 at this place. this place that ended up, I guess, being like a drug front, actually.
Yeah.
And I think like, I think my first nice guitar I bought from them was a Les Paul Studio. I'm pretty sure it was likely stolen. But yeah. They sold me my first guitar and a little, do you remember those Gorilla amps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's this little yellow Gorilla amp and it had built-in distortion. I remember the guy being like, don't use a distortion. Like, you want to practice. And it's like, of course, you get home, the first thing you want to do is turn on the distortion.
It's so much easier to play with distortion.
Yeah, it sounds so much cooler. Anything you do sounds better. I mean, but yeah, it's so funny. Like, you know, they're like, you know, don't do this. You want to kind of like get your technique down. It's like, yeah, no kid cares about that.
No.
Yeah, I remember our mom, what I remember about that, and by the way, I meant to say this earlier, I also remember in our parents' car, like, there were always like these books, like, kind of like Dan Brown, but like all these books that you were probably about to return that were like always kind of in the back.
Yeah, sometimes I couldn't do it the same day. So
there'd just be all these books that I'd be like, why do we have all these like discount books?
All these discounted hardcover books. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. Anyways, but I was going to say, I remember mom being like, I can't take you to this place anymore because I think it's like not safe. Like it. Yeah.
Ah, yeah. Something. Wow. It was really weird looking back because I would go, they taught lessons in the basement. And I remember I had this teacher who would just chain smoke cigarettes and teach me like seek and destroy. And it was like dark down there and it was like their store. I mean, and then something happened with it. I can't remember, but like the guy sold it and then it turned out he didn't own it anymore. But then once he got the money, he left the country or something.
Love
like it.
It
was some kind of crazy story. My mom was definitely plugged in and I had was totally oblivious. And
no
I was
idea.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys. He made it happen without actually owning the building.
Yeah. He's like one exactly what you were talking about earlier. And then I went to another teacher, Dave Baker, who I still talk to, who is an incredible guitar teacher who still plays and does a lot of great stuff. But yeah, it was exactly out of one of your stories, that whole experience.
That's great.
It's amazing.
So was crazy. He ever apprehended or
I don't know. You know, I didn't find out until after the fact and I've tried to do some research on it and I'm not sure, but who knows? For all I know, he could still be on the run. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine being on the run your whole life.
Like, I know.
It just must insane.
I know.
Insane.
I can't imagine because I find it so hard to sometimes just relax and I'm not on the run. I mean,
yeah.
Imagine.
Like, yeah. Well, Jonah, can you imagine like if your scam hadn't been stopped that day by Matt? I want to say his last name was Santa Barbara. Is that correct?
Yeah.
We don't have to use his last name. But
that's a great name.
It's such a crazy name.
Yeah,
that's his last name.
His
Santa Barbara.
Matt Santa Barbara.
Yes. Oh my God, I would kill for that name.
Yeah. Wow. I think it's worth saying. I think he'd be excited that we're just crazy.
Wow.
And he has a really responsible sister. She worked at Borders. But anyways. I wonder if like she hadn't stopped you that day, if things would have gotten even bigger. You know what I mean? Like what would have eventually gotten you to stop?
I actually had drawn a line because I had told someone about this scam and they were like, oh, I like did a shortcut. I just took a book off a shelf and returned it.
Whoa.
And I was like, okay, that is illegal. Like that, there's no gray area with that. So that was beyond it. So I felt like I would have kept doing the same thing thinking that,
Yeah. Well, I guess eventually Walden Books and Borders would have both gone out of business. So
they did. Yeah, they both did. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But do you think you would have gone bigger? Would you have gone to something bigger?
Like bigger, like at a different store or just like?
Different products. Like, would you ever have done like a car or something?
Like buy a used car and then try to return it at a dealership.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know it's been done at least once in the history of Earth.
I don't know. I don't think I was that ambitious back then, but maybe. You never know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I think I don't know if they still do, but I feel like when Nordstrom first opened at our mall, that was a thing with them. Because remember. I don't know if you remember this, but like Nordstrom would return anything and then like mom and dad had this friend and he brought his girlfriend over and she talked about how she worked. This is an insane story. She talked about how she worked at Nordstrom and someone once returned this dress and like she opened the box and the dress was completely soaking wet.
Yes.
And she returned And she was like, and I had to take it because like Nordstrom like accepts everything. So like, wow. I wonder if it's like, if you had kept doing it until Beechwood Place had a Nordstrom, which is probably when you were about like 16 that opened. Cause I remember because I was a member of the Nordstrom fashion board.
Whoa.
Not a big deal, but like kind of like a middle.
What is that?
Yeah, what is that? I don't know any of this stuff.
So when Nordstrom opened at our mall, I was probably like 13 or something. No, that's not right. I was like 16 because I remember I used, I like really pulled out all the stops in terms of my interview. So basically they're like, we're interviewing teens to be part of the Nordstrom Fashion Board. And it was obviously just a way to get people to shop there. Like it was just like a way to make it like, you know, more known that the Nordstrom was in town.
Right.
But I remember they like, I tried to dress like really cool for my interview. And then it was like, who's the most inspirational person in your life? And I remember talking about mom and just trying to really wow them, even though they accepted everyone. Like it wasn't like, anyway, I remember being like, my mom's so inspirational to me. And I remember at the time, like I had just finished, or I was still having my treatment for when I was like sick. And I was like, she's helped me through like so many hard times. They probably were just like, well, we don't care. Like, we're just trying to get teens to like shop here. So anyways, I got accepted. I got accepted to the Nordstrom Fashion Board. And then basically what it was once a month, they would have these like meetings, like where you would learn different things about Nordstrom. So like 1 month it was like, they had like a specialist from like MAC makeup, like show you kind of about makeup. And I remember I was also really into school. Like I was really like serious about my homework and stuff. So I remember just never wanting to go to these meetings. And one month they had us come like, and they showed us how you like style a mannequin. And then the other thing, which I never, I guess, got to do, even though I think I because I was again, busy doing homework or whatever, was you would go into the store and which this used to be a thing that I feel like they don't really do at stores anymore, maybe because online shopping is so big, but, and they would give you like an outfit that they were selling and you would model it by like walking around the store in it.
Yes.
Wow. Is a thing that they used to do. Remember like stores would have, especially like, I feel like this was a big thing for like fur stores that would sell like fur jackets where like there would be a woman walking around in one where you'd just be like, how do you interact with that person? But yeah, so I remember like other people doing it, but I never got to do the modeling piece of it. But yeah, that was the Nordstrom Fashion Board. I think I went on three meetings and then I quit.
Oh my God. Wow.
I don't think I officially quit, but I just stopped going to the fashion board meetings. So kind of silenced the group. But
when you're walking around the store, you know, like as a model, is it under the guise of like shopping or is it clear that you're a model?
That's a great question. I mean, I feel like if I was doing it, people wouldn't have necessarily known. But I think you're supposed to, I don't know, like if you're supposed to be saying to people, like, you can get this outfit here, or if you're just supposed to kind of act like you're wearing it and then people be like, that's a cool outfit. Where did you get it? That seems like too many steps. Like, I think they know,
right.
They know what you're doing.
Right.
And Jonah, your friend worked at Nordstrom. There was a girl in your grade who worked there. I can picture her, but I cannot think of her name. And she, and the other thing about Nordstrom, which they still do, is that after you would buy something, they have to come around the counter and give it to you. They can't pass it over the counter.
Wow.
So, I cannot remember the name of this woman.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking, and I think, last thing I want to say about this is like, I also worked at a record store in high school. It's Record Store Ultrasound Music. And, you know, talking about sort of like the kind of ethics of that era, we just had a whole wall of bootleg concerts. They sold bootleg t-shirts, everything. And I did my senior project there where like we have to work somewhere for a couple weeks. And I remember taking photos of stuff and the owner being like, don't take photos of that. Like, you know, it's like you could go in a store. It's like no bands, no labels were getting any money from this stuff. But it was
right.
It was just that was how it was in the 90s a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I also want to say something that will kind of be a nice button to this story talking about our first instruments, which is that, you know, our parents live in this condo now. They're no longer in our childhood home and they have been going through stuff and they wanted to get rid of our piano and they wanted to donate it. And I guess in my mind, we had like an incredible piano, but I guess, you know, it's an older piano. No one really wanted it. So my mom dropped my name. Like she was like, you know, Vanessa Bayer learned how to play piano on this piano and they took it.
Oh, wow.
So that's like a bit of a, is that an ethical, like it's, I mean, it's true. It's true, but also, you know, I think that flies in Cleveland. Maybe not. This is no burn to Cleveland. I love it. Maybe if that happened, I think in New York, they'd be like, we don't give a fuck. But I guess in Cleveland, which I don't,
big stuff.
Again, not trying to burn Cleveland because, you know, hometown pride, but they took the piano. So,
well, there's you and Joe Esterhaus. Yeah. That's it.
Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break, but we'll be right back with John Worster. Okay, so we are back. Now, John, we're going to play a game with you now where we bring up kind of nostalgic things that are making a comeback.
Yes.
And if you're into them, you can give them a yes-stalgia.
Yes-stalgia.
And if you're not into them, you can give them a no-stalgia.
No-stalgia.
What if I don't know what they are?
I think you'll be able to mostly know what these are, or we'll okay. do our best to explain them.
Okay.
But great question. Okay. So the first thing is, there's going to be a new Peanuts holiday special. However, instead of Charlie Brown, it's Lucy stepping into the spotlight, this description says. This shows her trying to plan the perfect New Year's Eve party. And as Linus details in the footage, Lucy's end of year mission comes about after being snubbed by their grandmother on Christmas. So basically, I watched the trailer. The grandmother decides not to come to their place for Christmas. It really affects Lucy. And so she decides to like throw this New Year's party. And she's really kind of rigid about like the rules for like people coming on time and dressing up and stuff like that. What do you think, John?
My first question is, does the grandmother have an actual speaking voice, or is it the adult sound?
Well, I think that you don't, I think she just doesn't come.
Oh, okay.
You don't know, like, but I mean, it's possible you hear a phone call or something where she
That's
calls
what I'm wondering.
In.
Okay.
Right. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, who is it that said this? Wu-Tang is for the children. I think Peanuts is for the children.
Got it.
So I think the children should always have Peanuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
ODB said that. That's who said that.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So I think Peanuts, I'm for it.
You're for it. You're giving it a yes-stalgia.
Yes-stalgia. Yeah.
Yes-stalgia okay. from John. All right.
Jonah, what about you?
As you know, I'm a huge Peanuts fan.
Huge. We went to the Charles Schulz Museum.
We did go to the Charles Schulz Museum. I read his biography and got really into the whole history behind Peanuts. And, you know, if you read the book, John, have you read the book, the Schulz book?
No, I know of it, though. Yes.
It's really fascinating because a lot of stuff happening in his life, it's pretty dark, and it's a lot of stuff happening in his life he's kind of expressing through these comics.
Wow. Okay.
And it's really fascinating, kind of like as like a psychological study. So I got really into it, and I started rebuying the old ones. And then, yeah, we were on a family trip in California, and there's a museum where you can go. And we went with our parents and Vanessa when we were out visiting family, and it was really cool. And I'm not as into like current peanut stuff, like it being licensed. Like I'm more of a purist, I guess.
Right.
But I am pro any sort of Peanuts related stuff for the most part. I'm cool with it. So I give this a definitely a yes-stalgia. What about you, Vanessa?
I would give it a yes-stalgia too. Now, I will say I was watching the trailer and it is, I mean, I guess I could have looked into this more, but obviously they have to change the voiceover actors because they're like kids. So it's like the Charlie Brown voice was like interesting hearing everyone's voices because you're like, maybe that's something that's really nice about it is kind of what you're saying, John, is it's like it's nice to bring new Peanut stuff to kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm all for it, especially because I think it is nice that it's focused on Lucy. You know, Charlie Brown's gotten to do a lot of stuff. Love Charlie Brown. But I'm just saying, I think it's great that they're bringing it back. So I give it a yes-stalgia.
Yeah. And if the Schulz estate is listening to this, which I assume they are.
Of course.
You know, I know like, you know, we see them a lot of like Peanuts in the MetLife insurance commercials. Like, let's just not be too loose with the licensing. Let's just be picky with where we want to put these characters, you know?
Yeah. This isn't Kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. This isn't Kiss.
Okay, Jonah, do you want to introduce our next topic for Yes Nostalgia?
Yes, I do. So this is actually I found this article, and then the whole time I thought it was something different. It's about the return of Mall Madness.
Jonah, do you want to say what you thought it was, the return of?
I thought it was Marble Madness. And I was like, Vanessa, we should talk about Marble Madness. I love that game. They're bringing back, like, marbles are come back.
Yeah,
like,
and I was kind of like, I don't totally remember Marble Madness, but I kind of do. But it turns out that the reason we were having kind of trouble remembering is because it isn't a real game.
It was Marble Madness. Yeah.
It was Mall Madness, which was by Hasbro. It was one of the most beloved board games of the 80s. It combined shopping malls and ATM cards for an amazing game that was surprisingly fun to play. For the uninitiated, which I'm assuming is all of us.
Yeah.
Mall Madness saw players control shoppers who had to manage a set amount of money while shopping for a list of 6 items. The game included a speaker that would announce where the sudden sales were being held so that the players could get the most bang for their buck. The new version of the game, according to Hasbro, have all the elements, including the ATM cards, 22 shops, a shoe store, nail salon, and 2 new floors of stores. John, what do you think of the return of Mall Madness?
Wow. I was never aware of Mall Madness.
I never
knew about it.
Me neither.
So it's an actual board game. I didn't know people still played board games.
I think they do. Yeah,
they must. I'm kind of into it. I mean, I worked in a mall for years, and it ruined Christmas for me. But maybe I would play that. Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm into this game. I'm into this game.
Okay. So you're giving it a yes-stalgia.
What about you, Vanessa? What's your take on Mall Madness?
I can't believe that I wasn't into this. I guess I was more into Girl Talk, and more specifically Girl Talk Dateline, because I can imagine they kind of, in a gendered way, especially in the 80s, really targeted young girls with this game, especially given that it had, you know, a nail salon, et cetera. Although, just given the times. But so I would say, you know, I'm into it. I think it's funny how Monopoly has a little bit of this too. Like, when you're a kid, it's so fun to manage money. I'm into it. I hope that they are successful with this new venture. I know malls are not as popular as they were in the 80s these days, but I'm all for it. You know, maybe it'll also kind of give new life to the world of malls, and maybe people will be more interested in them. I'm into it. I'm excited about it. What about you, Jonah?
Well, like John, I also worked at a mall. This was pre-record store. I worked at a luggage store.
Oh, I worked there too for a summer.
You did? Okay. Yeah. I worked at this luggage store, Cleveland Trunk. Our dad's friend owned it. They had stores at a mall and then at another mall that was basically next door. And I worked at one of those little kiosks.
Yeah.
And so I sold backpacks, but they had an actual store like down the hall from me that had way more stuff. So I think I was more of like an advertisement. So I sold such few stuff. I mean, I basically just read, but I was at the mall a lot. So I think I'm conflicted about this. Like, I like the idea of board games. I like the idea of kids not just doing stuff on their phones or on screens. But I do feel like a game where you're just like shopping and like is kind of weird. Like, it's very, I'm not sure that's the best messaging. So I'm conflicted. But I'm going to go with a yes-stalgia because it's a board game and it's just a tactile thing. Let's interact with other people. Cool.
Yeah. And I think as someone who is on the Nordstrom fashion board and kind of got the backs, you know, kind of got to see behind the scenes how a department store at a mall works, I think worthwhile.
Yeah, that's true. Vanessa, do you want to introduce our last topic?
Sure, I'd love to. Now, this one is a little controversial or dicey, some might say, for me, because I have sort of like a history with this brand and their commercial. There's a new nostalgic Planters peanut commercial starring Reginald Val Johnson, who was the dad on Family Matters. And it's kind of selling peanuts in a nostalgic way. Now, I've talked about this. I talked about this, I believe, on our Shallow Hal recap episode, where when I was living in Chicago, I auditioned for a Planters commercial, which at the time I didn't say the brand, but I think it's kind of the only peanut brand that, anyways. But so I auditioned and I had to play like a quote unquote like unattractive woman or like an ugly woman. And anyways, and then, you know, we found the commercial and everything like that. But anyway, so I've always felt like who's in charge over at this, you know, like who's just coming up with these commercial ideas. But this one has Reginald Vell Johnson, who we love. And I think we're going to watch it really quickly, but I just wanted to point out a few things about it. One is, again, controversial for me because of my history with this brand. Jonah's friend Sergio is in the commercial, we realize. This is one of Jonah's friends from college, right? From Ithaca? Is that right, Jonah?
Yeah. He does a lot of acting now and producing. And yeah, Vanessa sent me this. She was like, is this your friend? I was like, oh yeah, I was in a band with this guy. We were in a David Bowie tribute band. We were in an indie band called City of Robots, a very kind of Built to Spill-esque band. And so, yeah, I know this guy pretty well. I mean,
okay, so that's pretty interesting. And then also, like this actor, Reginald Vell Johnson, on Family Matters, he always really reminded me of our dad, Todd, and also a huge Family Matters fan. I don't know if you guys are as well, but I always really love that show. So there's a lot happening with this commercial. And why don't we watch it and then we can kind of talk about whether we're into it or not.
Jared, where are you? I'm Nutty Holiday.
Here you go.
Mom?
The holidays are here. It's time to be together. So feather up those bangs. Grab your shoulder padded sweater. We're decking the halls. No one is taking any calls. Except for Uncle Billy buying futures on strip malls.
So basically, Jonah's friend Sergio, not playing himself, playing a guy, gets sucked into like an 80s music video. His family and everybody's dressed really 80s. And then somehow, like, I don't totally get, like, and again, I know I have my feelings about them, but like, there's like a ornament on the tree that's like of the Planters peanut guy. And then he gets like a gift that has like a photo of him. I just, to me, I guess what they're saying is at the end of the commercial, like, we've been around over the holidays for so many years, which you could say about like basically anything that's been around for a long time because the holidays happen every year. So like, get ready for the holidays this year and like buy Planters peanuts and you'll also get like, you know, you could win some nostalgic stuff or something.
John, did you know Vanessa used to work in advertising?
I really
no,
did.
No, no.
It's true.
Maybe it's why I'm extra hard on these commercials.
You're
I mean,
very hard on these commercials. Very, very, very much so. My big takeaway is, should I be offended or flattered that Sergio's hair in this 1980s throwback is exactly what my present day hair looked like?
I think flattered. I think it's come. Okay. I think it's come full circle. I think your hair looks fantastic, John.
Well, John, what do you think? Are you in? I don't. This one doesn't fit into the game as neatly as like a product that would be coming back or a show or something. But
right,
are you into this whole, I guess, nostalgic campaign?
I think it's nostalgic. I believe
it is.
Yeah, that's what they want you to call it.
It's weird to be at a point in life where the stuff that's getting kind of spoofed in these nostalgic things is an era where you were kind of already fully formed, or I was, you know,
right,
like, as an adult. As an adult. So it's weird to be at that place in life, but I enjoyed it. I felt like the one woman looked a little bit like Susanna Hoffs in the Bangles, and everyone was having fun. And you know, if we can't have fun with peanuts, what have we got?
Right. Totally. So you're giving it a yes, Dalja.
I think so. I have to remove myself from any kind of, I can't take it personally.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Fair enough.
Totally.
Yeah.
Now, Jonah, what about you?
I'm going to give it a yes, Dalja. I mean, yeah. I mean, Sergio, I think, is incredibly funny, Sergio Chili. And so it's great to see him in it. I also like the, Vanessa, I don't know if you picked up on this, like, there's a lot of, like, controversy, I feel like, every year about whether Die Hard is or isn't a Christmas movie.
Right. And with Reginald Vell Johnson being in it, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so I think when she's like, yes, it is, like, I think that's a reference.
Was he in the movie?
Yeah, he's in the movie.
Oh.
Yeah,
he's in the movie.
Okay. He plays a cop in the movie. So I think like that's kind of a wink at that. So I think that's
I like that.
Clever for, you know, a peanut commercial. I know, Vanessa, you have your own issues with the brand.
Right.
And I don't want to... you know, I'm going to side with you over Flanders any day of the week. Yeah. But as far as this specific commercial,
yeah,
I think it's a yestalgia. I think it's really funny, and I can get behind it. What about you?
Well, you know, look, I love Reginald Viljoenson. I think, you know, again, love Family Matters. And, you know, I know Sergio's your friend, you know, fan of Sergio too. So like the thing that kind of that you said just now that really pushed me over the edge of being into it was when you said the thing about that is very clever that they said, is it a holiday movie about Die Hard? That was kind of like an extra layer that they threw in. To me, that's really interesting that they did that and very smart. And so as much as I have like a, you know, issues at times with this brand and their commercials, I'm going to give it a yestalgia as well.
Wow.
Well, this was so much fun, John. We had such a great time with you. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you?
Well, I'm not going to give out my address, but I'm on all the socials under John Worster, JonWurster. That's where I can be found, and I've dug my own grave with this. So send your horrible photos through DM on Instagram, and I'll be upset by them.
And check out the new Superchunk record when it comes out.
Yes.
New Superchunk record coming February. That's the big stuff. Mountain Goats have some year-end shows. I'm not sure when this is going to air. But Tom and I are still doing the best show after 75 years. And we'll continue to do it.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming by, John. This is so great.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if you enjoyed that, please subscribe to the podcast and keep an eye out for next week's episode, How Did We Get Weird, where we will discuss more stories from our childhood and cultural milestones like our first instruments.